This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. A string of terrorist attacks in Germany has called the nation's immigration policy into question. It seems this was an inevitable result of Germany allowing so many Muslim migrants in. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about how the nation is responding to these attacks. This is a really important trend to watch. Israel has been reaching out to several neighboring Muslim states, another interesting trend that shows just how much the Middle East is changing because of the rise of Iran. These nations seem willing to put aside their differences for the moment in order to find ways to check Iran. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall about why Israel is doing this and why there's a danger in this policy. Parents today don't have enough authority. That's the conclusion drawn by a physician in a new book called The Collapse of Parenting. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Dennis Leap about the problems that this lack of authority creates in the lives of our children. And we're going to conclude the program by talking about why babies and nations fight and how not to. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. A week and a half ago, an attack in Nice, France killed 84 people. Just on last Wednesday's program, we were talking about a man storming a train in southern Germany and hacking people with an axe. That was just the first of five terrorist attacks that have rocked Germany in the period of 1 week. And this is really something that we're watching closely, especially from a standpoint of biblical prophecy. We've been watching to see how Germany in particular would respond to provocations by radical Muslims. I have Trumpet writer Richard Palmer via Skype from our office in the UK to talk about this. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
Can you just start by giving us a rundown of these recent attacks since the one that we talked about last Wednesday?
Right. Well, they've been the attacks have had various different motives, various different people behind them. I think this is where a lot of the media gets kind of stuck or bogged down in just looking at the different motives or how they relate to the Islamic State. But really, they come down to, there's a common denominator. They're all by people from Muslim backgrounds. A lot of these attacks involve recent migrants from Syria and Afghanistan, the same place where that is the source of so many other migrants within Germany. So we had the axe attack that we talked about last week. Then on Friday, we had an Iranian who was born in Germany just shoot a whole bunch of people outside of McDonald's. It looks like he hacked somebody's account on Facebook, posted posts saying he was giving out free food, and then just tried to shoot as many people as possible. This was the deadliest attack. Now, he appears to have been obsessed with mass shootings, and there's been no kind of published radical Islamist background. I think we should reserve judgment on that, though, given the way that the German police have tried to cover up any links to radical Islam or recent immigrants with past attacks. They have said that there are links to Anders Breivik, but they haven't spelled out what they are. They haven't put forward any strong evidence of that. I think if they had compelling evidence, they would have published that by now.
And remind us of what that is.
Anders Breivik, that was probably the biggest attack that Europe has suffered in recent years. That was 5 years ago to the day on that shooting on Friday. And that was where a right-wing terrorist in Sweden went and to a youth camp of for the left-wing, one of the left-wing political parties, and just shot as many people as he could. So then on Sunday, there was a machete attack. A pregnant woman was killed by a refugee who had arrived from Syria about 18 months ago. The police, the government, they're not calling that a terrorist attack. He knew the victim. There are other people that got stabbed as well. It does look that that was more like murder. But again, it was a migrant from Syria. And if you have a migrant from Syria stabbing a pregnant woman with a machete, you know, that's going to impact. That have an impact on Germany and on what people are thinking about migration. Then on Sunday, you had a bomber try to blow himself up at a music festival. He made a bomb. He carried it in a backpack. Thankfully, actually wasn't the smartest cookie because he hadn't bought tickets to the festival and therefore wasn't allowed in. and so he blew himself up outside. He didn't kill anyone, I don't believe, apart from himself, but he did quite badly injure a group of people. If he had have been allowed in, it would have probably been much, much worse. And I think there may have been an accomplice who was a more recent immigrant there. So he was from Syria. He was due for deportation. He was meant to be deported quite some time ago to Bulgaria, because that was the place he first entered the EU, and he'd applied for asylum in Bulgaria. His deportation was held up a couple of times, was delayed because he had tried to commit suicide. So again, there's, you know, Germany being merciful to migrants, being soft on migrants, and because this guy wasn't deported, he tried to blow himself up at a music festival.
Now, we're in the middle of the immigration crisis, really over the past year, we've been talking about the inevitability of some of the individuals who are streaming into Europe, and Germany has been really one of the primary destination spots for these immigrants, of some of these people having radical backgrounds. And there were a lot of people warning about this, that they were coming in with an intent to do harm. And it seems like, even though it's difficult to maybe trace in each one of these cases, here's a migrant that came in with an intent to do harm, and that's exactly what he did. There's certainly enough connections and links that it's hard not to look at this and say, you know, this is pretty much what we were warning about, and here it is coming to fruition. German lives mm-hmm. are being taken because of this. And yet, it seems like to this point, we haven't seen that kind of response among Germans that we might expect to see.
No, and at the Axe attack, he did claim allegiance to Islamic State, and the Islamic State claimed that attack. The same with the backpack attack. He claimed allegiance to the Islamic State and had a lot of Islamic State propaganda. So again, very clear links. Then today's attacks, the attack in France, which is just been absolutely shocking, where you had two people again proclaiming allegiance to Islamic State, even as they carried out the crime, took some hostages in a church, slit a 90-year-old priest's throat. And I think that's going to have a huge resonance. You know, Catholicism in France, it's a little like Anglicanism in the UK. You know, the state is strictly secular, but Catholicism, it's right at the center of society. Churches are often at the center of every village. You know, the priest is a pillar of the local community, and to just slit the throat of a 90-year-old priest while he's saying mass, that's going to have a lot of resonance for Catholics all across Europe, people all across France, everybody all across Europe. And that's, again, a very overt connection to the Islamic State. And then the most recent attack just a few hours ago before we came on air, there were shots fired at a hospital in Berlin. It looked like somebody came back and shot his doctor. We don't know anything more really about that yet, but I mean, the rate things are going, you could have another couple of attacks by the time this interview goes out tomorrow. It's just, and I think that's what, like you said, there's an element of I told you so, or that kind of, you know, we warned about this with these migrants coming in, but just also the sense of loss of control, of everything's coming apart, of, you know, it's just a day after day after day of attack. Spiegel had an article they published yesterday, and Mr. Stephen Flurry quoted from this quite heavily on the program yesterday. I guess the article was published on Monday, actually, but it was called Apocalypse Now, A Year of Crises, Shocks, and Fears of Terror. And it really does sum up what the world, well, it looks like to a lot of people right now, but especially to Germans now that they've had these attacks on their soil. And it starts by saying, has the world gone mad? This question is occupying the minds of many people these days. It feels like the world is out of step, that multiple crises are encroaching upon us, and that the distant world of international politics is about to get dangerously personal. And then it says, we're witnessing the destabilization of the world as we've known it since 1989. So I think there's a huge feeling now, not just about fear of migrants, but just a fear of the world is falling apart, we're not in control, and that could end up really hurting me and my family.
Now, the German politicians, they seem to be doing everything that they can in order to prevent that sort of apocalyptic thinking among Germans.
Absolutely. I've been just surprised at the sang-froid of a lot of the leaders in Germany in the wake of all this. So you had the head of the German police union. He said, "We are not at war. We are not even under a state of emergency." I mean, you contrast that even, you know, we saw a week ago the French Prime Minister Manuel Valls for getting booed for not doing enough to fight terrorism. Now, back in November, he was saying France is at war. But the French now, and I think rightly, say, well, you weren't doing enough. In Germany, you've got the head of the police saying we're not at war. Germany has not raised its threat level. There's a difference, I think, in Bavaria. The local leaders there, I think, are much more agitated about this. But the national leaders, you've got, you know, Angela Merkel has pretty much had no response to anything about this. There's been no big speech or you know, attempt to comfort the nation or give a nation a vision of what we're going to do now. Instead, she didn't really comment at all on anything about this until Saturday. And even then, it was a speech that was one paragraph long. Then you've had Thomas de Maizière. He's the interior minister. He's responsible for immigration. He has been trying to go around and argue that actually the open door to migrants has nothing to do with these attacks.
Are they really trying to kind of set themselves in opposition or show a contrast between themselves and Francois Hollande, for example, or other European leaders who've taken more of a blustery approach to in response to these attacks?
I don't think that's a deliberate effort to do that. I think it's more, in a lot of ways, these people own the crisis much more than Francois Hollande does, say. You know, Francois Hollande, we can criticize how well the French administration did in dealing with the problem, but it's very clear they did not cause it, the problem in France. You know, these were people that moved to France in the 60s and the 70s, mm-hmm. and it's a problem that's been allowed to fester for France for decades. He didn't solve the problem, but there has been problems with radical Muslims in these enclaves for decades, and now they were inspired by the Islamic State and they carried out these attacks. So there's no loss for Francois Hollande to come out and talk about the problem. But Ms. Merkel, Thomas de Maizière, they did a lot to cause the problem within Germany. You know, historically, the German Muslim population, they're Turks, rather than coming from these other areas. They allowed the migrant crisis to happen. They allowed these migrants to come in. And so if they come out and say, yes, there's a problem with migration, yes, Germany has a Muslim problem, and we just let a million Muslims in last year, some of whom may be radical, you know, they're doing themselves real political harm. They're having to come out and admit that they're wrong. And so I think it makes sense that their first instinct is to deny that there's a problem at all, to kind of cover it up and to try and pretend that nothing is happening.
It seems you talk about, say, the attacker who went after the 90-year-old Catholic priest and some of these attacks that they're doing that really should have a strong resonance within the people of Germany. They are in so many ways trying deliberately to provoke Germany, and you have to think that they have to be somewhat shocked at how difficult it is to do that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's partly due to the German leadership. I think also there's still a strong, especially in the older generation within Germany, there's a strong sense of historic responsibility. I mean, they know what their nation did in World War II. It's still talked about very much in everyday politics. Whenever they talk about their army doing more, that's debated. That's brought up. France, after the Paris attacks, they put down 10,000 soldiers in the streets. Germany is constitutionally barred from doing that because of its post-war legacy. And I think there's a segment of German population that are aware of what they did and do not want to come close to letting that happen. And so because of that, I think it means that it will take a harder push before they snap. But they're not going to be able to put up with this indefinitely. No nation is. And I think it's just, I mean, it's the point that Mr. McDonald made back in November about the migration crisis. If you pretend that there's no problem there, if you refuse to reject, if your kind of solution is, okay, well, we've got this historic, or we're worried about this historic guilt, if I can put it that way, therefore we're just going to pretend there isn't a problem, you're just setting yourself up for an explosion later. You're setting yourself up for people swinging around en masse to the far right who are saying that there is a problem. You can understand their intentions and the reason why they don't want to talk about it, but it's going to have the opposite effect to what they want.
Well, and there's already plenty of evidence within German politics to show that right-wing swing that you're talking about and the public support for causes that maybe would have been more taboo even just a few short years ago, much more frustration with the current policies of the leaders that you're describing, and really linking those immigration policies and the problems that Merkel has had because of that with these attacks. It seems inevitable, especially given the determination that these attackers have to continue these provocative acts, that this is going to result in a major explosion within German politics. And we definitely need to keep our eyes on that. It's really one of the most important prophetic trends that we could be watching. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Richard Palmer, who's working on an article on this subject for thetrumpet.com. You can watch for that. And in the meantime, we do have an article up called Terrorism Spills Blood on the Streets of Germany. Richard, we always appreciate your insights.
Thanks. Great to be here.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
There's an interesting trend in the Middle East right now. Israel is drawing closer to several Muslim nations. We've seen high-level visits between Israel and Egypt, Israel and Saudi Arabia, Israel and Turkey. And it really points to how much concern there is in the region over the rise of Iran. To talk about this, we have Trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall via Skype from our office in Jerusalem. Hello, Brent.
Hello. How are you going?
Doing very well. This is pretty unprecedented, or it's kind of a unique development here. Maybe you can just give us an overview of the trend as you see it.
Yeah, it seems like this has been a trend that was kind of kept under wraps till about, I'd say, about 6 months ago. And that is Israel's search for friends in the Arab world. And typically these are nations where Israel has been seen as more of an enemy in the past. And yet, the growing situation in the Middle East, the changing situation in the Middle East over the past 3 years has led both Israel and these other Muslim nations, particularly the Sunni nations, the more moderate Islamic nations, as we would call them, to change their modus operandi when it comes to relations with Israel. They are seeking out Israel as well as Israel seeking out relationships with them. And it's kind of picked up over the past 3 or 4 weeks, especially with when we saw and we talked about even on this program the normalization of relations between Turkey and Israel. And we know that that was being worked on for a little bit as well. So they already wanted to do that about a year earlier. But then after that, we had, I think about a week after that, Egypt's foreign minister visited Prime Minister Netanyahu in Jerusalem. There was he tweeted a picture, or Netanyahu did, of them watching the Euro Cup soccer final together. So a really open, just really public in the closening relationship between Arab states and Israel. And then just this past week, we had a Saudi former general in their army, a retired general, come and visit Jerusalem once again. He had a delegation of businessmen with him as well, and even security officials with him as well, to discuss the regional situation with the Israelis. So it's like they might have been doing this before, but over the past month, it's become extremely public.
Yeah, it makes me wonder how problematic this would be from a PR standpoint for these Muslim leaders. The fact that, you know, you're saying this is something that probably has been going on for some time, but hasn't been publicized. Now they're making it more public. I'm sure that they would face some kind of a backlash from some of their own peoples.
Yeah, they certainly would. And that's why I don't think in the next, you know, 6 months or even ever, we're going to find like a Saudi embassy in Israel, just because the public opinion against the Israelis, against the Jews in all of the Arab states is very negative. And there's no real reason for these Arab states to go that far. They can still get what they need by doing more covert meetings, where even, you know, we're not going to see the king of Saudi Arabia show up to Israel. He's got lower level people doing these. Whereas Israel, on their part, they would love to trumpet the fact that they've got all these Arab neighbors becoming more friendly terms, because it shows that they aren't actually the pariah in the Middle East that they've been painted out to be for the past 60 years. There are bigger fish to fry. So even the picture of this tweeted photo from Netanyahu of the Egyptian foreign minister and him watching the soccer game, the Egyptian foreign ministry came out and said they basically walked past the TV and somebody quickly took a picture, and they're downplaying this whole event because they are torn between a rock and a hard place, these Arab states.
Well, let's talk about that hard place here.
Right. Well, the reason that most of these Arab states are coming towards Israel is because the greatest threat in the Middle East now is obviously Iran. And they have a working relationship with Israel and a growing even security relationship with Israel. They recognize that if Iran's nuclear program is to go forward, that the Israelis are the most capable to strike at it without causing a huge war of sorts. If Saudi Arabian jets flew over and took out the nuclear sites in Iran, that could lead to all-out war in the Middle East. And yet the Saudis and other nations know that Israel could do that and probably get away with it like they've done at other sites. We also have the largest sectarian war going on right now surrounding Israel. In Syria and in Lebanon, you have the two sides of Saudi Arabia and their interests in Lebanon and inside Syria, and then Iran's interests in Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Assad regime, and they border Israel. So you can see that they've got a natural ally in Israel at this time, and they need Israel to function within that security umbrella because of Iran's growing march across the Middle East. And the other factor is, of course, because America is no longer there playing that role.
Why would they make it public?
That's a really good question. I feel like that might have something more to do with the role that they are looking to play in the peace process. Each time these leaders come over to Israel, they talk about how, or they meet with in Ramallah with Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority leadership, and they talk about their desire to move the peace process forward. So I feel like they have to have meetings, and they're going to have them, but if they can paint it and kind of paint it in the sense that they're there for the Palestinian cause, that still resonates with their population to a large degree. Now, it has been that for the past 30 years, the Palestinian issue has been painted as the reason that there is Middle East upset, and the greatest, you know, thing upsetting contributing to the deteriorated relationship with Israel has been the Palestinian issue. It's been the biggest thing in the Middle East, and yet the Iranian issue has taken over that, taken that mantle. So, and yet, when you talk to the public in these Arab states, they love Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's the third holiest site in Islam. They believe that Israelis are unfairly treating Palestinians. If you look at some of the statistics of Arabs in these states, of what they feel with the Israelis, it's extremely low, of course. And yet the government sees that it needs to work with them. So as long as they can go to Israel and painted that they're there to support the Palestinian cause, I think that they will get a pass from their populations.
Now, from Israel's standpoint, like you said, you can see how they would be pleased with the photo op of sitting down with Egypt's foreign minister and so on. But really, when you're talking about making accommodations with nations that really are antagonistic toward Israel, it seems you're playing a somewhat dangerous game here.
Yeah, it does get back to even that same point we're talking about in terms of Egypt's normalization of relations with Israel, that it comes at a time when it is serving the interests of these Arab states. They need Israel. That's why they're involved. They would much rather not upset their public. And the Israelis, they're just taking it as they can get it. I mean, it's obvious to the world that the relationship with America isn't as great, and they need some allies. They need some security arrangements, even if it's not to fight Iran, it's to ensure that, or to try and grow a situation where they would have a peace treaty like they have with Egypt at this time, like they have with Jordan. They would love kind of to move towards that direction with these other Arab states. And yet the heart of the Arab states hasn't changed, even though the political situation has.
Right. There are a lot of factors that are putting pressure on this situation and that are driving events. And you can see Israeli politicians watching the situation and trying to manage it in the best way that they can. But this is really a situation where having the perspective of biblical prophecy really gives you a clear insight into what's going on here that you wouldn't have if you were just looking at things purely from a geopolitical or a pragmatic standpoint. Maybe you can just help us to get that perspective on what we're seeing here.
Yeah, just looking at it from a pragmatic geopolitical point of view, you can't blame the Israelis for reaching out to these states. And you might see it as this window of opportunity that once Iran is stopped would be gone forever. So they're acting on that right now. But biblical prophecy shows us that this very relation, that it shows us actually, in fact, that Iran is not the greatest threat to Israel. Iran is not going to destroy Israel, at least put it that way. They are a great threat to Israel, but prophecy says they are not the ones that are going to attack Israel. Prophecy, Bible prophecy shows that it is both German-led Europe, but then also these very nations that they are having closer relationships with right now by Egypt, the other Sunni states, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Jordan, the other Gulf states, these are, and even the Palestinians, these are all areas there that are going to eventually look to Israel's demise and see to it along with the help with Germany. Now, I think it's very interesting. I'd just like to read one scripture, and this is where we get this prophecy from, based out of Psalm 83 and verse 3. It says this about this group, this confederacy, this alliance of Arab states with Germany. It says they have taken crafty counsel against your people. And then it talks about how they have said to each other, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel be no more remembered. And then they consulted together with one consent or one heart to destroy Israel. But the first part of that passage talks about this crafty counsel. And inside that, it shows that there is a policy of deceit that is being worked out in this in this prophecy. So it's not like they're always enemies and they're going to come up against Israel and fight them in battle and defeat them. It is, along with other prophecies that we know about from of Germany and Europe, they are going to arrange in like a peaceful confederacy. No one's going to expect them to turn on the Israelis, and yet this prophecy says, and it's in the context of this deceit or the peace negotiations or something like that, where they're turned on, the Israelis are turned on. That's why I think this is very specific, specifically going to fulfill Bible prophecy.
Well, Israel is definitely a state without a lot of options, and you can see what's motivating them to take the course of action that they are, although even looking at it from just a purely physical standpoint, absent the prophecy, you have to think that the policy of trusting in nations that really don't have your best interests at heart is eventually going to create some real problems, and we can expect that to happen in the time ahead as we watch these relationships develop with peoples that are full of contempt for Israel. So definitely something that shows the treacherous road ahead for the Jewish state. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about Israel and its outreach to Muslim nations. He's working on an article on the subject, and you can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Brent, thanks again for your time.
No problem. Good to be here.
Is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
How much authority should parents have in the lives of their children? There's a debate over this question. A lot of parents are uncomfortable with being an authority. So a parent takes her child to the doctor for a checkup. The doctor says, okay, I'm going to look at your throat now. And immediately the parent turns it into a question. Do you mind if the doctor looks in your throat for a second, honey? And afterward, we can go get some ice cream. And the child unsurprisingly refuses to let the doctor do this test and has to be restrained in order to accomplish the test. This actually happened to Dr. Leonard Sachs. He's written a new book called The Collapse of Parenting, How We Hurt Our Kids When We Treat Them Like Grown-Ups. He says parents are turning every statement into a question. And trumpet writer Dennis Leap is a grandfather. He's written a great deal about parenting over the years based on his own experience and based on, well, the teachings of the Bible. He's working on an article based on Dr. Sachs's experience and many others, and he's here to talk to us about this. Hello, how are you?
I'm great. Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me in.
So the basic point here is that parents are uncomfortable with being the authority in their children's lives. What's the evidence that this is the problem?
Well, it is kind of amazing. Of course, thanks for bringing out the fact that I'm a grandfather. It's grandfather of eight. I've raised four daughters, been around a long time. And you just see some of these things just happening in society. If you see it at a restaurant, I know just recently, I watched some people at a restaurant, and they ordered this really nice meal for this child. And the child was not real happy with, you know, the way it came out. It wasn't like, it's like children likes things out of boxes. You know, they want I know our kids used to really like the ramen noodles. And then if you order them some really good noodles at a Chinese restaurant, they'd say, well, these aren't ramen noodles, you know, kind of thing. So you see those kind of things where parents are kind of like in our culture and our society is like parents feel like they have to be cool or they have to be like the friend, you know, of the child when really that's the problem is my parents never felt obligated to be my friend. They were the authority in the home. And we were told, well, you're going to eat these vegetables. And if you don't want to eat them, that's fine, but that's it for tonight. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem that the way the parents want to kind of reason with their kids. They want to cajole with them. They want to talk to them. You know, they want to just, you know, try and get them to be, well, to reason with them and to think, well, this is the right thing to do. But the role of a parent is to really be an authority and say, well, you maybe don't understand this, but this is what's best for you, and therefore I decide what's going to happen.
So I would imagine that there are a lot of people, there's probably a lot of factors contributing to this, but there would be a lot of parents who would say, I didn't have the greatest relationship with my parents, and maybe they were more authoritative, but it was all about rules and regulations, and I really want to have more of a I want to be closer with my kids. I want to have a good relationship with them, and I want them to like me. You can understand maybe the impulse behind that, but where do we go wrong in that equation?
I think that's a really good point to bring out. Is when like Leonard Sachs, I really, of course, you know me personally, so you know I've read a lot of books on child rearing. And when this one came out, you know, I thought, oh, man, The Collapse of Parenting, what is this going to be about? And, of course, then I read some of the reviews, and I know I've read some reviews from Slate. And, you know, the one parenting advice columnist, when she wrote her article in the book, she says, definitely do not read this book. And she says, I'm not asking you. I'm telling you, do not read it. Well, that made me want to read it even more. And so the point is I think where people misinterpret what Sachs is saying, he's talking about being an authoritative parent when the issues really require it. But he says in the book, in other words, if you have, you know, a 2-year-old telling you, I do not want to eat vegetables, I want French fries, or I do not want to eat vegetables, I want to eat ice cream. That is not a time for negotiation. That's a time to say, the ice cream is not good for you, you're going to eat your vegetables, and you're going to learn to eat your vegetables. Being authoritative does not mean that the parent isn't nurturing, that the parent isn't, you know, loving. And Sachs recommends that you get back to this idea where, you know, mothers and dads and the children have dinners together. Moms and dads go on vacation together, and they do exciting things together. That, you know, moms and dads get together and they have game nights where they play games together and they talk together. And so being authoritative does not mean that you're distant from your child. In fact, being authoritative means that you're aware that you need to be closer to your children and you need to develop a parent-child relationship. But it's not like you're their buddies. You're still the authority.
It seems one really valuable point that he makes is teaching your children the value of humility, that's really a virtue that has been lost today in our effort to really make sure that our kids have plenty of self-esteem, regardless of their effort, regardless of their actual achievement. Maybe you can just talk about that and why that's so important.
I think it's really kind of just exceptionally good writing when he brings this out. Now, it's a little bit complicated in a way to talk about it maybe so quickly over the radio. But I know that you've written some things about it when, you know, we can praise our kids. And the point is we live in a culture today where we tell our kids they're amazing no matter what they do. And when we focus on our children, we say, well, yeah, he has a 4.0 average, and, you know, he's now the 10th in his class. But what that does is that, what about, he gives this whole example of, he talks about how fragile kids are today because of this, because sometimes they're going to smack right up against reality. And, you know, he talks about this one young girl who just had this image of herself that she was just the brightest student in the classroom. And, you know, she was, you know, top student. She was getting all these grades and they were, you know, the highest grades in the class. And so as a junior, she decided she was going to take a senior physics class, and it was an AP class. She couldn't pass it. Mm-hmm. She was absolutely crushed. Mm-hmm. And that's what he's talking about, humility, is that you want your child to maybe learn the value of working for a grade, than instead of just believing, well, they're just the smartest person on earth. And what this girl, where she really lacked the humility to admit, well, you know, maybe physics is going to be a little harder for me, mm-hmm. and maybe I need to work harder. But because she couldn't pass the quizzes, immediately she fractured. She crumbled. She couldn't do the work, and she was so embarrassed in front of her students, she refused to do the work to prove, because she couldn't prove that she was absolutely right.
So this fragility of ego, that's definitely something that can crop up in a child who's been coddled and maybe treated like they're an adult from the very earliest age. What are some of the other problems that result from that style of parenting?
Well, I think one other good example he brings up is parents seem to not know when to really kind of, well, like light a fire under their kids. And he said that's a big problem. And he does talk about this this other family where their son is he wants to be a professional gamer.
Yeah. A lot of kids, I imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, and because they know they make $100,000 a year, but the dad, the boy's a little overweight. The dad was a great athlete. He knows his son could be an athlete, and so his son, one of the big games he plays is a football game, and so his son said to him, "I'd really like to play football," and so his dad encouraged him to go out and try and make the team. Well, he's been sitting, in his bedroom playing these games all day long, and the dad even noticed. He said, "Well, to connect with my son, I'm going to play this football game," and the kid just beat the pants off of him, like in this exceptionally high score. So he said, "Okay, we're going to go out and start throwing the football." So they go outside and they throw the football around. Then the son goes to tryouts. And they make him, the first day, they make him run sprints and they make him run a mile. And the kids' times are terrible. And the coach says, "Look, your times are terrible. There's a few other of you guys that need to work. Meet me at 6 in the morning and we're going to start working on this." He says, "I'm going to have you run again. We're going to put you in the gym. We're going to give you weights." And the kid wouldn't go. And so the dad, Mark, this Leonard Sachs is a family physician, so he's the physician over this kid, and the dad goes to him and says, "Well, what do I do?" And Leonard Sachs says, "Make him go." Mm-hmm. But the dad didn't want to offend the son, didn't want to upset the son enough to say, "You're going to go and try out and make it." And right. And that's what he's talking about, the culture of fragility. Is, if you go back 40 years, if parents would say to their son, "Well, no, you go. You can do this. You go to the trial."
Right. This coach is actually trying to help you out here.
Right. Exactly. And so, but parents do not seem to be willing to do that today. And he said that, to be honest, it's mostly in America where this is happening. And the other thing he brings out, and he said that a lot of the American teenagers are depressed. They are fighting these things. We are a society with the highest level of medicated kids. And he said it's because what the children really need is parents that are willing to stand up and say, "No, you're going to go ahead and you're going to go try out. Give it your all. Mm-hmm. Give it your best." And so what if he doesn't make the team the first year? What if he makes it the next year? But you should be doing that as a parent. You should be encouraging them. And that's a culture of working. That's a culture of trying to always improve yourself instead of the culture of saying, "Well, you're just amazing.
Right.
Well, I'm glad you are playing that computer game. Oh, wow, you did it for 10 hours. How wonderful is that?" He said that is just not helping our children.
I would imagine that there would be a lot of parents who would start to see some of the bad fruits that come from that approach and maybe feel like, well, it's too late in a way. If you're not in the habit of exerting that kind of authority in the life of your child when they're 16, it's a little bit hard to assert that kind of thing, and it's not going to go over well with a kid who's never been accustomed to that. But for a child who grew up with their whole lives with a parent who was basically giving them the boundaries and saying, "This is what we expect, and you're going to need to step it up in this area and that area," and they're rising to meet that standard, then it's going to be a lot more natural for them to be comfortable with that when they get older.
Exactly. And the thing that the Dr. Sachs brings out, and which I think is really good, he said you have to start from the very beginning with those kind of things, but it's not cruelty. It's just realizing that as an adult, you do know more than that infant that you're carrying home. And I see it, and I've talked about this in articles before. We travel through airports, we go to restaurants, And we see these things continually. And so I know that Slate, you know, really criticizes Dr. Sachs because he doesn't quote all these studies. Well, to be honest, they're not being honest because he quotes 400 studies in the book. And if you look at every chapter, he's got notes of references on everything. I mean, this book is really well researched. He's traveled to how many different countries? He's been to Australia, New Zealand. He's been all through Europe. He's studied these things in high schools and colleges, and he's found out about how, you know, in other countries like Australia and New Zealand, there's such a culture of respect in kids for their parents. And they love their parents and they listen to their parents. He said, but that is gone in America. Hmm. And it's really affected the schools. And of course, you know, I've had a chance to work in the public schools here, and the students do not respect their teachers. It's a problem, even in the best schools here in Edmond. And I've seen it myself. And the thing is when parents don't take their job, when they don't take on the responsibility, that does really, it messes up the parent-child relationship, and then the child does learn to disrespect the parent. But then that transfers where they disrespect police, they disrespect teachers, you know, they disrespect community leaders. Parents are saying we need to teach our children to respect authority. Well, that begins at home, and it begins with the parent-child relationship.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Dennis Leap. He's working on an article about this subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Always appreciate you coming in and sharing your insights with us.
Well, thanks for having me. I'll be happy to come back anytime.
It's time for today's last word.
Back in 2010, a movie came out called Babies. I never saw the movie. I think it was basically a documentary about babies growing up. I just saw the trailer. But I will never forget the opening shot of this trailer. In this unscripted scene, a boy and a girl are both maybe 8 months old, calmly sitting side by side in a hut in Namibia, Africa. The girl notices an empty plastic bottle on the ground in front of the boy. She grabs it. He protests by pushing her hand away. She cries out and looks up. She's hoping an adult will intervene, and no one does. So she leans over and bites the boy's shoulder. He howls and begins hitting her. And when she fails to react, he throttles her by the neck. She screams, and he immediately goes back to his activity as if oblivious to her suffering, but he gives a sidelong glance to make sure he escaped parental scrutiny. The girl, alone in her despair, flops forward with her face in her arms, and then in one final comic insult, when she coughs, a cloud of dust flies in her face. It's really funny, but it's also kind of distressing. In less than 40 seconds, these two children depict the tragicomic story of humankind. We covet, we take things by force, we retaliate, we escalate silly feuds, we dodge responsibility, we lack concern for others, we deceive, we cover our tracks, we sulk, we pity ourselves. Watching it unfold between infants is funny because it's so universal. And it's so plainly absurd. This is our human nature. Human nature is selfish. You have it, I have it, just as surely as those two babies in the African desert have it. And it plays out in several ways in our lives. Just like those children, our relationships are beset by conflict and hurt because of that self-oriented nature. Selfishness is at the root of untold human suffering. The comedy in a childish spat disappears when our human nature plays out among bigger people with higher stakes, causing greater suffering. Relationship problems stem from breaking the basic spiritual law of give. Whenever someone puts himself ahead of the other, you end up with problems in all relationships. Wherever you see discord, self-love is at the root. But amazingly, modern society stupidly encourages self-love. Parents have come to think that their number one job is to nurture their children's self-esteem. We avoid discipline and we teach our preschoolers to say, "I'm special, look at me." We give students higher grades for less work. Sports programs award trophies just for participating. Thanks to reality TV, we have a generation of fame seekers. Celebrity obsession has turned vanity into a virtue. Facebook, MySpace, YouTube, these facilitate self-promotion. Society is experiencing a boom in self-admiration. Well, guess what? All this self-love is making us miserable. And yet you still have people who look at the strife and the spiritual emptiness that result from too much self, and they'll tell you the real problem is insufficient self-esteem. Modern culture says you have to love yourself in order to love others. But it's far more accurate to say that self-love kills the ability to love others. Studies have actually shown that the more narcissistic people become, the greater their tendency to lack emotionally warm, caring, loving relationships. The more self-love we have, the less room there is in our hearts for actual love, that is, genuine outgoing concern for others. James 4, verses 1 and 2 ask, "What causes wars, and what causes fightings among you? Is it not your passions that are at war in your members? You desire and do not have, so you kill, and you covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and wage war." There's a lot in that passage. Pursuing self-interest over the greater good. That's really the source of all conflict, whether it's international war or a childish feud over an empty plastic bottle. The solution is the diametric opposite of the self. It is the law of God. Jesus Christ expressed the spirit of this law as two simple commandments. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. All the specific laws that God gave against killing and hatred, against coveting and materialism, against sexual immorality and so on, they're all just expressions of this overarching principle of love. God's law and his way of life are always giving, outflowing, thoughtful, selfless. Yes, we need to take care of ourselves. That's part of the love your neighbor as yourself formulation. But that isn't putting the self ahead of others. God's way is opposite the self-love that brings sorrow and suffering, discouragement and frustration, conflict and contention. The way of love is the way of happiness, of joy, satisfaction, and harmony in relationships. That's not our natural way. In fact, Romans 8 and verse 7 says, "Our human nature is enmity against God, for it's not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be." That's why you see the selfishness that leads to contention in every corner of the world, even in a little hut with a couple of eight-month-olds. In the heart of every person on earth smolders the love of the self. Today's society, rather than trying to control those flames, fans and stokes them into a wildfire. Don't follow that trend. Strive to douse self-love in yourself and in your children by practicing and teaching love toward God and love toward others.
Thank you.
I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. You can send us your thoughts on the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, and Dennis Leap. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with this thought from Aristotle. We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.